Hello, and welcome to the AgTech So What podcast. Emerging technologies are rapidly changing the global agricultural industry, and we believe that this revolution is only getting started. But there's still too much hype out there and too big of a disconnect between ag and ag tech. So on this show, we try to bridge that gap. In each episode, we bring you the story of a different innovator in agriculture and try to find the place where ag and tech meet. I'm your host, Sarah Nolette. Before I tell you about today's guest, I want to share something we've been working on for the past few weeks. You might remember that we partnered up with Decipher to bring you four episodes on getting ag tech ready. Well, we've teased out the insights and examples from those four episodes and created a free ebook with five practical tips to help you or farmers you know, because hopefully you'll share it, to get ag tech ready. You can find the ebook on our website or in the show notes. So today's guest is Victor Friedberg, an entrepreneur and investor who shares his systems approach to investing, lessons from successes in his portfolio like Beyond Meat, and opportunities for farmers to benefit from the trends that he's seeing in the food system. Victor started as an entrepreneur in Silicon Valley, where he built one of the first social networks in the mid-90s, including raising money from Motorola Ventures and a few other Silicon Valley VC firms. More recently, Victor co-founded S2G Ventures, a VC firm based in Chicago, Illinois. We kick off our conversation with the story behind how Victor became interested in food and ag in the first place.
Going back to 2008, 2009, I was really starting to think about systems from the investment standpoint, but mostly as it related to energy systems and water systems, and specifically as it applied to things like off-grid micro for rural India or low-cost desal for sub-Saharan Africa. So really a global development perspective. And I had started a platform for investment called Launch, which was funded by NASA, State Department, USAID, Nike, and a bunch of other corporations to tackle these big global development issues. And at the beginning of those investments, we were really investing in singular companies. And I just started to think more about how those systems at a macro level were acting, you know, what were their leverage points? Who were the stakeholders? Where could capital and innovation start moving the system into just being better? And I did a rare thing. I took a vacation at that time, which was an unusual thing to do. And I went to Spain, and I was there with my girlfriend at the time. And I was in Valencia and went to the Central Market in Valencia, Spain. And it's this beautiful turn of the century Art Nouveau kind of building and all these different stalls with every vendor and farmer, each with their own little specialty. And I went walking up to this one farm and vendor who was selling peaches. And all they were selling was peaches. And I could smell the peach from almost 10 feet away. And when I bought the peach from Pablo and I just tasted it, it was like an epiphany. I had just never tasted a peach like that. And it made me realize that the peaches I had been eating all my life were just shadows of the real thing. And here I was a person of means. I could shop at Whole Foods or go to a fancy restaurant. But here at the Central Market in Valencia, an entire community from wealthy to working class were having a singular food experience that was superior to mine. And I just wondered why. And so that made me just take a step back and come to the realization, which seems self-evident now, which was food was a system. And as I looked deeper and deeper into that, I had the insight that that system was going to change dramatically over the next 10 years. And from that, co-founded S2G Ventures, which is a venture fund in the United States, to really put that soil to shelf systems investing thesis to work.
my personal journey into food and ag also came about through a vacation to a Spanish-speaking country. So we have that in common, which I imagine not a ton of people do.
That's great. What's your story?
I went to South America on holiday and ended up staying for almost a year and living on a number of different farms. And my moment, like your peach moment, was a tomato moment. So I was living on an organic farm and pulling weeds from the tomatoes. And I grew up in California, where there was a lot of conversation around organic as the answer to all of our problems. And pulling weeds in a hot, sweaty organic tomato farm really made me think about whether organic made a lot of sense at scale and how technology could be used to do a lot of these tasks that were being done manually in a way that was both sustainable and efficient, and kind of breaking that trade-off.
Well, that's a great story. And I think for your listeners, I think the message is there that everybody should be taking more vacations, and preferably to a Spanish-speaking country.
My story reminded Victor of a time when he was sitting right between the past and future of technology in agriculture.
So early in S2G, we had identified that sort of weeding was a big obstacle in regards to conversion of conventional to organic, and that if you could solve that problem, you could begin onboarding a lot of acreage and bring more organic fruits and vegetables and grains to market. So we were looking at a company that was spin out of Carnegie Mellon University, which is a very globally respected and renowned robotics university. And so there was a spin out that came out of there, and I think the company's name was Robot, and the idea was to create a autonomous weeder for row crops. And so we were, really starting to have a lot of meetings, and as we were diligencing it, we thought it would be good to, have it at one of these Midwest farm fairs, where, all the farmers in the area, come and look at different combines and different tools of the, of the trade. So we had sort of Robot come to that fair. And there's a picture I took from that farm day, which it was this, autonomous robot, which was a version one, pretty clunky, looking. It had the visualization tower, it had, a bunch of wheels, and it was carrying, a little trailer behind it. But you could see sort of the vision for what they wanted to do. And there were all of these Amish and Mennonite farmers who were, all in traditional gear and wearing their trousers and suspenders and, the hats and the pipes. And, they've been farming the way they've been farming for a very long time, and probably for good reason, somewhat skeptical of, technology. But it's this picture of about 14 Amish and Mennonite farmers around looking at this autonomous, weeder. And I just love that photograph.
Fortunately, Victor still has this photograph, which we've included in the blog and show notes for this episode. One of the things that Victor is known for is taking an ecosystem approach, looking at agriculture as a system and getting the right people around the table for a particular opportunity. People like investors, manufacturers, policymakers, or farmers who can really help that company to succeed. When S2G set out to raise their first fund in 2013, no one was really taking this kind of approach to venture capital in food and ag.
There are lots of venture capital funds doing food and agriculture, but nobody was thinking about it holistically. And so you had late stage CPG oriented growth funds, you had purely ag domain funds, you had the start of the Silicon Valley funds getting early into food, but they were looking at it in a very different way. They were looking at food as just another sector ready to be disrupted, which was an interesting frame. And so the idea of doing the first soil to shelf systems fund, and the approach we were taking to do that, which was, really to reject the Silicon Valley model. And I think there was some think there was some belief that, and some credibility behind the idea of how, you know, that was being positioned, which was, instead of thinking about doing investments in 10 companies, and for those 10 companies, let's not really worry about valuation, and let's not worry so much that 8 or 9 of them fail. You know, the one that succeeds, or the one or two that are succeeds, will return all fund plus, you know, carry, and, you know, kind of everybody will be happy. But to make that model work, you need outsized returns in comparison to historical norms. And, you know, the food and agriculture business has been around a long time. And so, you know, it was pretty easy to see that there weren't going to be a lot of outsized, you know, return multiples from that. So the approach I took was, well, let's not try to say that's what we're going to do. Instead, let's solve for just lower failure rates. Let's just have less companies fail. And let's really think about how systems investing and engaging with companies, you know, post-investment, taking this more sort of holistic approach to it, will just position companies better for succeeding.
For S2G, a key part of this approach was bringing in lots of experts, because they appreciated that ag is a complex system and that having deep expertise in all parts of it would be impossible. They had a saying at the time that guided this way of thinking.
There was a saying at the time, you know, if we were the smartest people in the room, we were in the wrong room. And that was kind of the spirit of what we were doing. You know, really wanted to learn, really wanted to do what's best for the companies in the portfolio, and how do we bring the right investors who understood the DNA and the aspirations of those companies and could really add value as those companies, you know, moved through their growth.
A story that illustrates this approach is one of S2G's investments, a grass-fed dairy company called Maple Hill Creamery that operates in the northeast of the U.S. At the time when S2G invested, around 2014, there weren't really any grass-fed dairy companies. Grass-fed wasn't a brand differentiator for consumers, who are still thinking mostly about organic. S2G saw the potential for Maple Hill to define this new standard, but they knew they needed help, so they brought in other experts as co-investors.
I personally, nor did S2G at the time, have any experience in grass-fed as a subsector. And so we sought out a fund called Armonia. Armonia had done, it's a dedicated fund in the U.S., you know, solely on doing grass-fed work, mostly on the grass-fed beef side. But a lot of those same principles from a systems perspective apply, you know, to dairy as they did on beef. And for Armonia, they felt getting a broader expertise on the dairy side would help them on their beef investments. And we would benefit from, you know, Armonia's experience on, you know, understanding about, you know, Savory Institute and, you know, diversity on soil and on, you know, the paddocks and how they're managed and the standards that the consumer are looking for and, you know, regional standards versus, you know, national standards, all of that stuff, which as a team, you know, we just started working together. And that company really found its tipping point, you know, when we built up the supply from, you know, first it was like 20, 30 farms in upstate New York, and those could have been like retired hippies all the way to other sort of Amish and Mennonite dairy farmers. And so, you know, you had to work both as an investor, but also most importantly, you know, the company in finding a way to create the first scalable, consistent, incentivized supply chain for grass-fed milk in the U.S. And we did all that hard work as a group, and you need an investor group that really was mission-driven.
Over time, Maple Hill Creamery has become the number one selling liquid milk at Whole Foods. Another key to their success, that also speaks to the systems approach, has been ensuring there are strong incentives and support for the farmers that supply Maple Hill Creamery. Victor explains how Tim Joseph, the founder, was able to think from a farmer's perspective and how critical this was when scaling up their supply.
Okay, he starts with one farm and now he's got to get two and then he's got to get five and then he's got to get 10. Like, how does he build this sort of supply chain and get people who've been doing it all one way for so long to take a leap of faith into a new brand and a new way of thinking about how to manage their farms? And so he found, the first farm, I think it was like a kind of retired hippie couple in upstate New York, and they really loved the grass-fed approach. They wholeheartedly integrated into the farm management, and they became the model. And so the incentives for becoming a grass-fed dairy farmer, giving offtake to Maple Hill Creamery, at the time, the dynamics were that the conventional dairy market was collapsing. There were an incredible amount of bankruptcies, processing facilities that had been doing conventional dairy up in upstate New York were all going out of business. Organic, certainly it had its heyday, but from a pricing standpoint, that was under a lot of pressure. And so, you had these conventional dairy farms who had converted over to organic, or farms that just started out organic, and they thought that those premiums were going to kind of go on forever, but there was a lot of pricing pressure put on there. So that was starting to cause instability within the organic market in upstate New York. So here comes little sort of Maple Hill Creamery, which ultimately could sell that they were kind of a lifeboat. And so they set up a pricing system. So I think at the time, if I remember correctly, conventional milk was going, $16 a hundredweight. Organic was going for $24 a hundredweight. And so Maple Hill basically said, listen, if you come into our network as a grass-fed dairy supplier, we'll give you $38 a hundredweight, just right off the bat, which was a big carrot for change at that point, given how much pressure all of those conventional and organic dairy farms were having. And then they went one step further and they said, okay, we're going to set the baseline at $38 a hundredweight. But if you're a seasonal supplier, we'll give you the $38. But if you become a year-round supplier, we'll give you an extra dollar, 100 weight. If you start doing rotational grazing, on your paddocks, and put in fencing, we'll give you another dollar, 100 weight. And so they kept building these price incentives that inspired farmers to do more, to make their farms operate at a standard that allowed Maple Hill to get consistency in their milk supply from a farm-by-farm-by-farm basis. And then on top of that, they did something that, as a small company, it's still amazing that they were able to pull this off, which is that they realized that, it takes time to really approach your farms from a grass-fed perspective, even if you're coming from organic. And so if you pledged your offtake from your farm, to Maple Hill and become an exclusive supplier, they would then buy your organic even before you had become a certified sort of grass-fed supplier. They would buy your organic at sort of market price, guarantee it. And then they would work, Maple Hill would then work that supply to sell it off into the organic markets for whatever period of time, whether it was 6 months, 8 months, a year, year and a half, for that farm to convert from organic to grass-fed. And that was really, for a small yogurt company, that was an incredible lift. And I'm very proud of the work that they did to really reinvigorate the dairy farms in upstate New York and create a financial incentive and an upside and security for farms that were really under an amazing amount of pressure.
Another area that Victor has invested in that has big impacts on producers is plant-based protein. Victor was an early investor in Beyond Meat, a company that has recently had one of the most successful IPOs in history. This space is controversial for sure, but Victor sees that it's creating some big opportunities, including for producers, as plant-based companies look to expand their supply chains beyond just pea protein isolate and soy, which are the common inputs used today.
There's a lot of experimentation going on now, you know, around different pulses and, you know, sort of chickpeas, and those show real potential, but those crops need to have kind of a denser protein content to it. So, you know, what can be done on the hybridization side to, you know, kind of up the protein levels, you know, within those crops? How do you start thinking about, you know, rotations and the like, you know, to do that? How do you think about hybridization, you know, to do that, and approach to genetics? So, you know, there's a lot of work that's going to be done, not only to just increase volume, which I think is an opportunity right here, right now, for supporting the all protein sector, but then what are the new protein sources that are agriculturally based that are going to come in to help create more complexity, you know, in the burger, bring more, a deeper taste profile, more umami. You know, there's a lot of things that are going to keep evolving that I think farmers can play a role in with these companies and with these products to build a better product.
More broadly than just plant-based, Victor is also watching some macro trends in the food system that he believes are also creating big opportunities for farmers.
Maybe I'm just being the eternal optimist here, but I think the coming decades are going to become a golden era for farmers. I think the types of crops, the focus on nutrition, the focus on differentiation that the consumer, you know, is having, the focus on farming practices and the like, I think that is going to provide farmers with an incredible opportunity. And the major transformation that's going to happen is that we're going to move from commodity to identity. I think commodity as an idea has a time stamp on it. I think the entire system for the last 50, 60 years have been, you know, on an agricultural side, has been focused on the idea of commodity, that there's a select number, you know, limited set of crops, you know, that ultimately it doesn't matter where it comes from or how it was grown, you know, what above and beyond, you know, kind of the top level specs, you know, what's, you know, in it that's ultimately, you know, ubiquitous, that it's used, that it's interchangeable. All of that approach, I think, is coming to an end. And what's going to come next, you know, for a consumer that actually cares is, you know, how things are farmed, what crops are nutrient dense, what soil practices have been undertaken. And if you can do all of those things right, if you could pick the right crops and the right rotations and do farming in a way that creates more, you know, value, there's going to be a premium that people are going to pay for that, because a commodity system in which we've bred out nutrients and we've bred out flavor and we've bred out all of these things are now being highly valued. And that's going to move us to an entirely different approach to farming. And for the farmers who see that future and can really curate the crops, you know, to those markets and, you know, do the harder work up front in terms of farming practices, but ultimately, you know, like you, I share the technology and new science, we're really going to help farmers make that transition to this higher value identity preserved market.
Realizing this future will be hard, really hard. But Victor says that, at least in the US, there are market signals that it's already happening. For example, big food companies that have scaled up organic brands have been dependent on sourcing their organic grains from overseas. But nowadays, they're losing confidence in these supply chains. And this is leading to change and opportunities.
The big food manufacturers we've been importing all of this organic grain from places like Turkey and Crimea, you know, which are not the hotbeds of stability and likely aren't organic or not always organic, but you're paying that organic premium, but you actually don't know whether what you, you know, have is authentically organic. You're going to need a domestic supply in the U.S. of verifiable organic grains, and your brands, you know, and your company's market cap are now tied to your ability to make these transitions. And so they're starting to do 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 year forward contracts, locking in premium prices to stabilize those supply chains, to allow the growth of those brands that have to transition to organic to do so. I'm not saying that's widespread, but it is the start of a set of systems players in which there are shared values and shared interests and shared risks that they need to solve. They're taking a long view on how to do that. And that is an opportunity for farmers.
Victor recently visited Australia, representing his nonprofit, Foodshot Global. Foodshot Global is a consortium of companies that are focused on creating a food system that's more healthy, sustainable, and equitable. I was fortunate to meet up with Victor while he was here, and I also asked him for a few reflections on his trip and the ag tech and food ecosystem here in Australia.
I was just, you know, really quite blown away at the level of innovation, you know, that's there. I think you have some world-class universities that are doing some important work on the R&D side, and investor groups starting to come into that ecosystem to really help turn those research opportunities into commercial and more entrepreneurial companies. And so it was just fascinating for me to see the start of all of that, of the dots being connected. And from a Foodshot Global perspective, we are seeking to help be part of, you know, that dot connecting, and then also to bring Australia into the work that we're doing on a global basis from Foodshot Global. So as a result of that, we had some great meetings, some partnerships that are in the process of formation. So I'm hoping to get back there pretty soon to start formalizing some of those relationships and bringing them into our protein challenge, which we'll be launching in the next couple months. But most importantly, just to get back to Melbourne so I can eat some more of that food, because that is a damn good food town.
I'm looking forward to Victor's next visit and to following what he's up to at S2G and Foodshot Global. Links for both of these organizations are in the show notes and on the blog. And don't forget, if you're a producer out there that's looking to get ag tech ready, check out our free ebook with 5 tips from previous podcast guests, brought to you in partnership with Decipher. You can find it on our website, agtechsowhat.com. See you next time. Thank you for joining us on another episode of Ag Tech So What. You can stay up to date with the latest episodes and news at agtechsowhat.com. And as always, if you have any feedback or other guests to recommend, we'd love to hear from you. Just hop on the website and leave us a comment or send us a message. Finally, if you like what you're hearing, and we hope you do, please share the podcast with a friend or leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening. Catch you next time.